Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindzeg, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is U.S. maritime strategy in an era of great power competition. With me to discuss the new Tri-Service Maritime Strategy, which was released this past December, are Rear Admiral James Bynum of the United States Navy, Rear Admiral Pat DiQuattro of the United States Coast Guard, and Major General Paul Rock Jr. of the United States Marine Corps. Rear Admiral James Bynum is currently serving in a dual capacity as the Assistant Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Warfighting Development and the Director of Warfare Development in the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. He previously served as a Director of the Assessment Division in the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. Rear Admiral Pat DiQuattro is the Coast Guard Deputy for Operations Policy and Capabilities. He was formerly a military fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Major General Paul Rock is the Director of Strategy and Plans at Marine Corps Headquarters. He was previously the Commanding General of the 3rd Marine Expeditionary Brigade and Commanding General for Marine Corps Installation Pacific in Japan. Rear Admiral Bynum, Rear Admiral DiQuattro, and Major General Rock, thank you for joining me today.
Hi, Jim. Thanks. Glad to be here.
Thank you, Jim. Pleasure to be here.
Thanks. Good to be here.
With your indulgence, I'm going to refer to you going forward by your first name. I appreciate that. And I think what I'd like to do is to begin with a bit of a scene setter. The Naval Service, which is, I guess, the collective term for the Navy, the Coast Guard, and the Marine Corps, released a strategy document late last year. It's titled Advantage at Sea, Integrated All-Domain Naval Power. Anyone who wants to read it can find it. It's available online. I must say it's relatively short as these things go, only coming in at about 27 pages, and it's actually readable. And I want to begin where the foreword to the document begins. And it's a foreword that is signed by the commanding officers of your three respective services. And the opening sentence is, the security environment has dramatically changed since the last Naval Service Strategy document was released 5 years ago. Jay, if I can begin with you, how has the security environment changed?
Well, Jim, I think a good way to sum it up is the pace of change. The things that have transpired in the strategic landscape have happened much more quickly than anticipated. The revisionist work in Russia and primarily the growth, the explosive growth of the Chinese defense architecture, particularly in their naval forces, has raised the sense of urgency and importance and made it a much more near-term decision space for us to consider.
Could I ask you to do a little tutorial for us, Jay? I mean, you're a Navy guy. Can you just sort of give us a quick overview of Chinese naval forces and maybe some sense of perspective compared to what the United States has?
Well, yes. If we go from what their strategic and stated aim has been, it's to be a counter-interventionist force. They've pivoted the whole of their military forces, including their Navy. And when we say Navy, they use a more holistic approach as well. So it's not just their Navy, it's their Coast Guard, which is much larger and armed, as well as an organization called the Maritime Militia, which is sort of a quasi-military group of hundreds or more of vessels that are intertwined with official activities in support of naval objectives. So that force, for example, this year by ship numbers in the Navy alone is exceeded the size of the United States Navy, some 350 to 360 vessels. We're probably 297 today. They have 25 times the shipbuilding capacity, 24 to 25 times the United States Navy. Their ability for long-range fires, hypersonic weapons, and the sorts of reach to feel that counter-interventionist force has really ballooned at a very rapid pace. That includes their naval arms, long-reach fires from their land-based long-range bomber and attack aircraft, as well as those forward outposts that they built in some of those contested waters off the Philippines, off of Vietnam, Senkaku's up near Japan. So it's really to kind of move out to their stated objective of being a hegemon, really, in my word, not theirs, but out to that first, and then influencing out to what they would call the second island chain out towards Guam and that perimeter to the Western Pacific.
And just for those people who aren't familiar with the geography of the Western Pacific, what will be the first island chain?
You're talking the Philippine archipelago, swinging down the rim, some of those contested islands, Spratlys, and that side up through and well inside of Guam, which would be sort of the second island chain, and a bigger swell up into Japan, the southern islands, there, Iwakuni, in that area off of southern Japan.
Just one last quick question about naval forces. At the upper end of the spectrum, when you start talking about aircraft carriers, the Chinese, at least at this point, are far behind the United States. I believe they have, what, two, maybe a third one coming on. We have 11. But as you point out, the Chinese have significant shipbuilding capacity. How would you rate the quality of the Chinese aircraft carrier? Because I imagine an aircraft carrier, to have an aircraft carrier group, is not simply about having ships, but about having the training, the men, the people, the technology to make all of those parts work effectively.
They started off with an old purchase of a former Russian jump carrier, so that limits your ability for reach and your deck size. They've since made an indigenous manufactured version of that. Their next step will be to build a more conventional carrier with catapult arresting gear, using some of the technologies we have just brought into the fore, electromagnetic catapults, advanced arresting gear, to enhance their reach and their capability off that platform. To your point, those first few are very limited in capability and capacity just because they're primarily a single type of aircraft. They don't have those long range ability to surveil that we would enjoy and have enjoyed for the longest time in the U.S. carrier naval force. But they're steaming. They're steaming in pairs now. Their operational tempo, their reach into farther regions of the ocean to expand a more blue water Navy is very impressive to watch the learning curve they've been on just in the past decade or so.
Pat, I want to go to you and talk a little bit about the United States Coast Guard, because I think for many people listening to our conversation are going to have an immediate question, which is, how does the Coast Guard fit into this? Because they think of the Coast Guard as being literally a Coast Guard operating just off the shores of the United States. And here we are talking about the situation in the Western Pacific, which is by any count a long way away from Los Angeles or San Francisco. So can you tell a little bit about where the Coast Guard fits in and maybe sort of complicate people's image of the Coast Guard?
Sure, Jim. A pleasure. You know, as part of Admiral Bynum's scene setter, the Coast Guard, our U.S. Coast Guard is deploying around the world in support of the naval service, working in many, many places alongside and under tactical command, operational command of the U.S. Navy. So currently in the Middle East, working in Bahrain, we've got a squadron of patrol boats helping enforce UN and U.S. security measures. I've been there since before 9/11, and certainly actually we're building the capabilities of that presence there, because in this gray zone, we play a unique role, both on the security side and on the safety side, no different in the Indo-Pacific region.
Pat, could I get you to stop right there? Could you explain for people what the gray zone is? Because I think it's extraordinarily important, and it doesn't quite align with how I think people think of great power competition, which is force on force, very clear military battles.
Yes, well, absolutely. So we view, and it's captured in our strategy here, the view of competition as an absolutely critical line of effort for the naval services. In competition, in that gray zone, are activities short of armed conflict. So it's everything from security in the day-to-day, and in this strategy, we capture it beginning at the homeland and projecting literally across the globe. The role of the maritime transportation system, the global economy, is absolutely linked to control and positive behaviors within that gray zone. And part of this strategy is our shared collaborative approach to call out malicious behaviors in that zone when we see it by name states, China, Russia, or anyone else, or by transnational criminal organizations that will seek to use the high seas into their benefit to threaten the rule of law and the many partner nations who happen to be along the routes of their business enterprise.
Can I draw you out on that just a little bit? Because one of the things that I find fascinating is the role that the Coast Guard has, and presumably could get bigger, in helping other countries develop their own Coast Guards. And that this is quite significant, whether you're talking about things like overfishing, illegal fishing, and the rest, but also sort of, again, your gray area activities, which don't seem to be purely military, but they seem to be more than just ordinary activities. We've often seen Chinese fishers or fishing fleets surrounding, harassing islands in the Western Pacific. So maybe you can talk a little bit about the Coast Guard's role there.
Absolutely, Jim. You know, the role of relationships and engaging with partner nations is absolutely critical in this new interim national security guidance, and it's captured in this strategy. As you mentioned, illegal, unreported, unregulated fisheries, certainly a great activity that absolutely pillages natural resources, migratory fisheries across the high seas. As an example of strengthening our relationships, just this past summer, we working very closely with Ecuador, and traditionally to stop the flow of illicit narcotics coming from South America through the Eastern Pacific up to Central America, Southern Mexico for further transportation across our southern border. But during a routine counter-narcotics patrol, our Ecuadorian partners requested assistance to address a distant water fishing fleet of Chinese vessels that are operating off the Galapagos. It's a seasonal activity where these foreign fishing fleets are trying to harvest the natural resources of, in this case, Ecuador. So using shared information, using a relationship which already exists to update the facts on the ground, and these are hundreds of miles off the coast in a very remote area, by using maritime surveillance aircraft, United States Navy, Customs and Border Protection, U.S. Coast Guard, use this collaborative approach to call out this activity, report it through established channels. IUUF is clearly a crime across the globe, in attempt to put a stop to it. At the same time, bolster our Ecuadorian partners under their own jurisdictions to protect their water. So there is great space under this strategy, this collaborative strategy, Jim, for those type activities. And that's in the South Atlantic, the Eastern Pacific, and in the Pacific, as you know. But this is global activity.
Yes, I also know you can find this problem off the coast of Africa. The Gambia has had problems. And I just, you know, when you talk about American foreign policy and working with friends and allies, there are clearly lots of countries around the world, smaller countries in particular, that would love to get U.S. help on that score. Paul, if I may, I want to shift to you and talk a little bit about the Marine Corps. And I'm really sort of curious, from your vantage point, this reframing of sort of saying we really need to think long and hard about essentially what is great power competition, and particularly great power competition with China, what that means for the Marine Corps. Because it's no secret, over the last two decades, the Marine Corps has been heavily used in the Middle East, but it hasn't been fighting so-called peer competitor, but fighting a very different kind of military force. What does it mean for the Marine Corps to sort of try to rethink its role for the different strategic environment?
Well, Jim, I would say that having to shift to great power competition from basically a couple decades of counterviolent extremism, arguably lower intensity conflict, although it's surely not low to the person in it, that shift is more than just a mental shift, right? It is a capabilities, requirements, and operational concept sort of shift that's required to be able to contribute to a fight against a peer, near peer competitor as part of the joint force. The Marine Corps has, for instance, prided itself on its joint forcible entry capabilities. Those capabilities, the concept, has existed as a centerpiece of the Marine Corps for well over half a century. Now it's evolved with technology and additional capabilities and things like that. But in many ways, the basic concepts unchanged. Well, we're potentially looking at great power competition against a competitor who is specifically targeting those kind of power projection capabilities to neutralize them in an anti-access area denial sort of fashion. And so we can either keep trying to plunge resources into that increasingly difficult regime, or we adapt to throw something else at a peer competitor, again, as part of a naval force contributing to maritime campaigning. And that's kind of the Marine Corps' look at it. I mean, its influence in how we are undertaking what the 38th Commandant, General Berger, has called Force Design 2030, which is the reshaping of the force, significantly reshaping capabilities and formations, again, to contribute to naval campaigning.
Could you just sort of spell out for us, Paul, what it means to reshape the Marine Corps? What in particular will change? I assume training remains the same, but we're talking about equipping the Marine Corps differently. How does that play out?
Actually, and just to make sure I hit the point, training will not remain the same.
Okay.
One of the significant investments that the Marine Corps is endeavoring to make in its Force Design 2030 campaign is to change how we train, both how we train and what we train to, because you know the training of the individual Marine is going to be essential in order to support the operating concepts that we aspire to be, you know, the best in the world at. You know, that includes things like distributed operations and what we call expeditionary advanced base operations, you know, where smaller formations that are lower signature, lethal, and are moving in a distributed manner, massing effects more than forces at a time and place of our choosing. You know, that requires a whole different way of training individual Marines. And that affects everything from our infantry battalions, which become, you know, in shorthand, more commando-like. We're looking at spending longer in initial infantry training to create more multifunctional infantry Marines, to Marines who are more competent in operating in and exploiting capabilities across some pretty non-traditional domains when you think of the Marine Corps. whether that's space or cyber or electronic warfare, that sort of thing. And the capabilities, when we look at, it's transformative for the force. For instance, one of the signature changes that we'll be making is the divestment of a significant portion, the vast majority of our cannon artillery, the artillery pieces that everyone's familiar with, and replacing those with much longer range precision strike anti-ship capable missiles, as a for instance.
I take your point that so-called low-intensity conflict doesn't seem that all low to people who are faced with it. I think it's an important point to emphasize. But I want to sort of think about the recommendations that the strategy makes, and there are essentially five. Let me just go through them quickly. It's to generate integrated all-domain naval power, strengthening our alliance and partnerships, operate more assertively to prevail in day-to-day competition, retain control of the seas to deny adversary, and to modernize naval forces. And we don't have time to delve into each of them, but I want to begin with the one that really sort of jumps out at me almost as a first thing to think about. And that's this idea of being able to control the seas. And I say that because of a point that Paul made about area access denial, the growth of anti-ship missiles. And so to you, Jay, as you sort of look at the potential for conflict for the Navy anywhere, but obviously thinking about the Western Pacific, how do you think about that in a world which is so different from the world, let's say, of battles in World War II, a world in which there's tremendous surveillance, people know where you are, it's much cheaper to build anti-ship missiles than it is to build aircraft carriers. So how do you think about that potential for conflict? Obviously, not because you want to have to fight a war, but you're hoping that your capabilities will deter others from doing things you don't want them to do.
Yeah, Jim, that's a great question. And that kind of gets back to your opening one. What's changed that called for us publishing Advantage at Sea? And it's really that acknowledgement that not only the growth of China, but the focus of the information age, the ubiquitous or attempts to have ubiquitous sensing, the reach of long range weaponry, the reach of space, cyber, directed energy, those things we haven't had in the quiver before that nation states, even much smaller, are finding themselves with the availability to do that. So it calls, that kind of leads to the last piece, which is we have to look at the force we have versus the force we need, right? What is the force that's survivable? What are the characteristics of that force? From where does it operate? How do you establish access and control? And where you can't control, how do you deny control to a potential adversary? Those are the places where we're thinking. And that kind of leads back to that operational piece. What do you do in the day-to-day? Because if I turn the other cheek or recede away to de-escalate, I may be ceding ground. And when ground and range and reach become so far, a lot of what might not have been tactical terrain in the past can be very strategic. So it all kind of ties together in that regard. We have to understand that access is going to be allies and partners that have great capability, not just access positions or buy with and through or some sort of a niche role. It's taking that more assertive posture to not yield ground. We've seen that just in the past week in the Philippine archipelago with U.S. and Philippine forces. So you can see how this gray zone is playing out. And really, it's the fundamental worldview of that Westphalian view of rule of law. That's why we fly, sail, and operate anywhere the law allows, because that's the key to stability and the economic prosperity that the world has enjoyed. Navies, by their nature, provide access and coverage. I mean, that's as old as CNO would say, that's as old as navies. But to your point, is a traditional navy going to be equipped to operate in that environment with the speed of compute and quantum computing and to play all that in? And that's the other piece of sense of urgency. If you get behind on that, on those growth curves, you may never catch up.
I'll just draw you out on the point you made, Jay, about navies wanting to sail the sea where international law allows. Obviously, we've had freedom of naval operations conducted through the course of American history. I believe the CNO is on record as saying we even do them with the Canadians as much as we like the Canadians, but we're trying to establish that under our view of international law, certain waters are open to everyone. Obviously, that's not necessarily the view that other powers take, most notably China. So can you sort of explain to us sort of what the Chinese claim is and how that conflicts with sort of the American view of what's allowed?
I think it's there's some cultural issues that we probably don't have time to delve into, but it's the issue that is the spirit of something is that becomes essentially fact. You go look at the rhetoric behind what was traditionally Chinese territorial waters, what was traditionally those things. And if you look at the legacy of a lot of that information, it's not that old. But that's been the kinds of things that have been moving in the assertion in their history books and the things they're teaching their population. And then that's where that encroachment and that incremental approach of fait accompli. I'll just keep moving until there's resistance. That's where some of those what were former features are now islands with runways and footing. So that's been it. And it's advertised. And they talk about swinging that down around towards Malaysia and some of those areas about that power and influence of establishing that as their footprint. We would say there's nothing special about an ADIZ in places or EEZs, but the international
EEZs,
global.
EEZs are exclusive economic zones.
Right. So there are things you can do in there. We won't do, you know, by common law, you don't do military training operations in a foreign economic zone. But freedom of steaming and regular operations in there just on the high seas are open. So it's those sorts of things that are important. And that's where kind of the opposing views, and that's just as much the lawfare issue of pressing the test as it is to look at a feature and then reclaim land on top of it. If I challenge the assumption of the international law and no one counters it, my established claim is accomplished. So that's where that works. And that's also some of that gray zone work that we have to do where our partners and allies and the Coast Guard can play a significant role.
I actually want to shift over, if I may, to Pat. And I'm curious, one of the recommendations is the importance of developing alliances and partnerships. And we've talked a little bit about, you know, what it is that the Coast Guard could do to help lots of countries, not just in Southeast Asia, in dealing with intrusions in their legitimate economic zones. But I'm curious, as you sort of look out at the world at Coast Guards, who among our friends and allies are also really good at it and who could be usefully enlisted in this effort? I'm not up to date on who sort of is at the top of the rank in terms of Coast Guards. And the Japanese have a very good Coast Guard, but to me, it's not clear whether it's a Coast Guard or actually a quasi-Navy. But if you could sort of give us some sense of who else can cooperate with us in this domain.
Absolutely, Jim. And for context, I would note that we talked about how the Chinese Coast Guard has grown significantly in the last decade. But on the other side of that coin, I just mentioned the Philippines Coast Guard has grown about 100% in the last decade. Vietnamese Coast Guard, 70%. The Japanese Coast Guard, about 50%. So there is truly a focus on this gray zone across the globe. We see similar investments happening in the Western Hemisphere. But to remain focused in Indo-Pacific, you know, what can we do to strengthen those relationships? A good portion of it is helping with capacity building. With any force comes the opportunity to train and equip and to update their protocols to address the latest behaviors under established norms on the high seas and to call out malign behavior when it's identified. So do that, and it runs across a host of activities from basic search and rescue activities, law enforcement, environmental response to higher end port security, information sharing, and the like. So it's really across those activities to help build the capacity. You know, as a U.S. Coast Guard, we currently have over 60 bilateral agreements in place around the world, Jim, that we've entered into with objectives in mind, but to strengthen these relationships under the current strategy, we look at those as opportunities to expand maybe each and every one of those to the fullness of what that relationship with that respective partner nation can be it IUU, illegal, unreported, unregulated fisheries, or just, you know, additional technologies that can promote information sharing for security or safety solution response.
Paul, can I ask a similar question of you? Obviously, the Marine Corps over the years has trained and fought with the militaries of numerous countries. As you're thinking about this strategy, are you thinking about changing or enhancing collaboration with existing friends and allies or potentially developing joint training exercises with countries that we're not used to operating with? Because I'll note, particularly when you're talking about China, you're talking about the South China Sea, a country that sort of comes to mind immediately is Vietnam. And we all know the history of the United States and Vietnam. Just sort of curious how the Marine Corps is thinking about partners in that part of the world.
The relationship with partners, of course, is different with every partner. I will say that in the area of great power competition, you certainly have an opportunity for a much more clear-eyed view about the partners where you're developing capability and the partners who have developed capability, who can immediately contribute, who are in many cases interoperable with the capabilities that both the Marine Marine Corps and the joint U.S. Joint Force bring. And in the era of great power competition, we are looking to build those relationships and at the high end of operations. At the same time, though, there are many other partners who are at different spots along the continuum of developing capability that we also maintain relationships with. I mean, in the Pacific, you know, your most accomplished peer partners for us from a capability standpoint, you know, the Japanese, the Australians, the Koreans, South Koreans, you know, folks like that who we plug in with, and you're getting a real top end workout because they have, you know, many of the same capabilities we have, and in some cases they have capabilities we don't have.
Yeah, I want to close our conversation by asking what may be the most sensitive question of all, which is, how do we pay for reconfiguring the forces? Obviously, Washington, D.C. right now is not a growth period for defense spending. I think most assessments are that defense spending may go up slightly, but this is not, let's say, like the 1980s with the Reagan defense buildup. Do we have the capacity to make the changes you're talking about within reasonable budget constraints? And I'll ask that of you, Jay, in particular, because the Navy is very expensive. We maybe get a big return on the investment, but nonetheless, aircraft carriers, submarines are high ticket items, ones that take years to develop. So how do we think about this in terms of the overall budget picture that the United States Navy and the other services face?
I have the added benefit of being a financial management guy in the Navy too. So that's a right up the alley for that. But I think it's also the opportunities we have in this space because of the insertion of technology. For example, in the past, when I built a warship, let's take one of those Ticonderoga class cruisers. I would fill probably a small single story house with nothing but wall-to-wall computer systems to support the fire control system. I can put all that on a solid state brick that'll fit in your briefcase. And I can change that at the pace of processor and do that on chip. In the past, when I'd have independent processors, I can do that like you can with your Samsung TV flat screen at home. So the infusion of technology gives us some economies we wouldn't have. So that's one way, inserting technology rapidly and doing things in a different way. Maybe, you know, our mind is shifting towards effects rather than platforms. And if I can move away from exquisite, expensive, and move to reusable, those things where, what is the potential for cyber? What is the potential for space? What is the potential for directed energy? And those things where my magazine depth may be much less limited, but have reach and effect. If I look at confusing those, closing the ability for an adversary to find, fix, target, and destroy my assets, that may be equally as useful or more so useful in the pace of operations should we be called to. So it minimizes my expense and my size. If I reconfigure for that vulnerability that you talked about, that may lead to a smaller configuration of a force that is has less cost driver to it and enjoys an added advantage of being harder to find. And in places where we already have some advantage, how do we rethink the way we might choose to have effect strategically? It also leads to the importance of those partnerships. If I have partnerships, just like we have any other time there have been global adversarial relationships that did wield all of the instruments, economic, industrial, et cetera, we've been required to have others on the team. So that's another force multiplier that we really haven't touched on today. It's not just for that access. It's really for their capability to help us do that. But those are some of the things where we're looking at. But and some of it is the last piece, which is the big R, risk. What do we decide to stop doing? Where do we decide to stop doing it? And what are the implications of that risk? And how do we do the best we can to mitigate that for the American people?
You're quite right, Jay, on the issue of what your friends and allies bring to the table in terms of capabilities. I will note that in that score, if you're looking at America's friends and allies in the Western Pacific, they all seem to be spending more on their own defense. And so I think that trend line is positive. I'm just curious, you know, for you, Pat, looking at the Coast Guard, you're the sort of the least expensive of the three services in the Naval Service, but you're not cheap. I mean, you're more than $11 billion in terms of a budget. What's sort of most important to the Coast Guard in terms of investments going forward? Is it ships? Is it people? Is it something else?
Well, Jim, there's no one easy answer. I would say it's the combination of all the above. But as has been called out under this strategy, is the requirement that we be integrated with the U.S. Navy and the U.S. Marine Corps as we roll out future investments, be it polar security cutters that will operate in the most remote areas of the globe, or our littoral craft, our fast response cutters working primarily in the Western Hemisphere for Guard, but to be integrated so the U.S. taxpayers users are getting the most out of a collaborative system of assets as opposed to singular services operating on their own and not communicating the like. So I do agree with Jay Bynum. It's a risk proposition for U.S. policymakers. Again, I'll look at the Arctic. We know that over time, the role of Russia, China, and other players making incremental gains in a very remote area will have strategic effect. So we're in the process of recapitalizing our one heavy icebreaker, which was constructed in the 70s. We have a class of polar security cutters that will be out later this decade that will provide the U.S. opportunity to project power, work with partners and all. But if we see that space, if we are not promoting a U.S. presence there, the risk is great as the global commons take over. Climate change has a huge impact in those remote areas, and we are ceding our role on the international stage.
That's a great point, Pat. We could do a whole show on the Arctic. I mean, for so long it was off limits. It doesn't appear to be off limits anymore. The Russians, we haven't really talked that much about today, have been very active in the Arctic. None that the Chinese are very interested as well, even though China's located a long way away from the Arctic. Paul, I want to close with you and ask sort of a broad question that picks up on the issue of risk that Jay and Pat both mentioned. What do you see as the consequences if the United States doesn't actually act on the strategy that you have laid out in your strategy document? The strategy document, in essence, says we're facing a changed world scene. We need to adapt to it. We need to make some actually fairly far-reaching changes in what we do, both at home and with others. And I guess my question to you is, if we fail to sort of act on the strategy's recommendations, what do you see the consequences being? What's the risk?
I mean, the risk are multiple. First of all, the nation expects its naval service and its joint force, when it's time to fight, we're going to win. But, you know, we have no aspirations to actually get into a great power fight, right? So we must be able to deter. To be able to deter, your deterrence has got to be credible. And then, as has been highlighted by both Jay and Pat already, even below the level of deterrence, we have to be able to compete. You know, that competition is what's going to inhibit, you know, peer competitors from just eroding the rules-based order and as well as America's place in that rules-based order. So we've got to be able to win. We got to be able to deter. We got to be able to compete. And if we don't embrace the tenets of the Tri-Service Maritime Strategy and move out on it, how we operate and how we develop the force and employ the force, that's the risk to America.
On that note, I'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guests have been Rear Admiral James Bynum, who is currently serving in dual capacity as the Assistant Deputy of Naval Operations for Warfighting Development and Director of Warfare Development in the Office of the Chief of Naval Operations. Rear Admiral Pat DeQuattro, who is the Coast Guard Deputy for Operations Policy and Capabilities. And Major General Paul Rock, who is Director of Strategy and Plans at Marine Corps Headquarters. Gentlemen, first off, thank you for your service. Second, thank you very much for coming on the President's Inbox and sharing your expertise.
It's my great pleasure, Jim. Thanks very much for the invitation today and to let us represent Navy.
Thank you, Jim. Yeah, on behalf of the Coast Guard, great to see you and everything CFR is doing.
And thank you for the opportunity. It was an honor.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, not of the Council on Foreign Relations, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by the one and only Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlick. Zoe also, once again, did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you very much, Zoe. We appreciate it. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening.